Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, and 720 WGN.
Happy Thursday, everyone. 12:09 on this Thursday afternoon. Pretty nice day in store. Got some showers out to the west, as you heard Jen just mention. She'll keep us posted on that. And I just want to let everyone know, Mr. Steve Bertrand, I just saw a Facebook video. Bennett, I don't know if you saw this, him drinking a Guinness at the factory. He took a nice drink of it about 3 hours ago. Got a Guinness little froth on his mustache, his beard he's growing to. Happily enjoying his time there. And he'll be back, of course, on Monday, I believe. Right, Bennett? Yep, he'll be back on Monday. But I'm here with you today, and we're going to jump right into the Wintrust Business Lunch with Mr. Ian Scher for our editor-at-large at CNET. Ian, thanks for joining us here today.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Always good to chat with you. I know we're all jealous of Steve over in Ireland right now, but we'll plow on through. And actually, I want to start with the Justice Department. I find this fascinating, suing Edward Snowden over his memoir, obviously for, you know, another additional violation of leaking things or talking about things without NSA approval. Although I just find something so silly. I mean, I know they have to go through the motions. What do you think? Did he think that after leaking all that stuff, he was going to send his memoir in for approval?
Well, I think more than anything, what's happening is that the government is trying to use any levers it can to pressure Snowden. And a lot of this, it's very clear the government has said that it's very displeased with him. You know, he is one of the most prolific leakers in American history. And the fact that he has not been brought to a courtroom and that he is currently living in exile in Russia really bothers a lot of people in the government. And they've said that publicly.
Is there anything financially they can do to kind of block any sales maybe of the book here in the United States from getting over to him?
Well, the struggle here, right, is the First Amendment. Right? I'm allowed to say what I want, but there are non-disclosure laws that he signed or non-disclosure agreements that in some cases require him to run the book past the government, and then also not to publish state secrets. Now he argues, and his lawyer at the ACLU argues, that what was published in the book wasn't anything new. It had already been published before. And so it's going to be interesting. You know, this is part of this ongoing kind of legal fight the government has to try and bring him into a courtroom. And by the way, he did an interview with CBS, which is, by the way, the parent company of CNET, and where he said that he would be willing to come back to the United States if he was assured that he could argue in court about this case and be able to say that, you know, he was doing this in the public interest. But he's not convinced the government would treat him equally, so he's not come back yet.
I imagine that this actually does wonders for the book, and I saw Snowden tweeted out the idea of this is the book the government doesn't want you to read. I don't know if you know, is it available online or is it only hardcover? Because I guess my ultimate question is there anything the government can do to block its sale from bookshelves in the store, or does that get into that First Amendment wary waters that they probably don't want to dip their toe into?
You know, I think that it looks really bad when you try to block a book from being sold, right? I mean, Amazon and a bunch of other publishers have made the decision that they're going to publish it. And, you know, trying to stop a book to be published, especially if it turns out the ACLU is right and there isn't anything new in there, is really a bad look. So I wouldn't imagine the government trying. You may also remember that if you go back to the Pentagon Papers from the 70s, which was an amazing moment in American history, you know, there was this argument about state secrets being published by the New York Times and eventually the Washington Post. And the way the Supreme Court came down on it is they said that public interest is more important than state secrets. And I imagine that the government doesn't want to have a repeat of that.
Yeah, the Ellsberg case is fascinating for anyone that maybe wasn't around there. It's good to get abreast of that. Certainly set some precedent for future things that we continue to deal with. You mentioned Amazon. We're going to shift gears to talk about Amazon and these big, bright orange lockers. I've used a locker similar, but it was for UPS, and mine was just like the picture you have at CNET.com, right next to a 7-Eleven. It's a great, convenient thing, and I imagine that they're expanding these things, right?
Yeah, so they apparently Amazon is planning to expand. It's got about 10,000 lockers in the United States right now, and they're all over the place. I mean, there's one of them in a local bookstore where I am. There's one at, of course, a university. So they're all over the place. And apparently now they're looking to evaluate over 1,000 new locations for new lockers every month and planning to expand into a significant chunk of those. So by the end of next year, probably, we're looking at having 20,000 lockers. Now, you have to keep in mind, there are way more people in the United States and way more Amazon users than those lockers. But that could help the company. You know, part of the criticism of it is that there's a lot of money spent to send a brown box to my home.
Right.
And that's gas in the UPS truck or the Amazon truck. Obviously, you've got the wages for the people who are driving it and all the debate about the Amazon drivers and all that. So this would help to solve some of that. And I think it'll be interesting to see how Amazon uses it. Already, by the way, in San Francisco, there are two or three, I forget, Amazon stores within a rock's throw of my office here. And they have actually started encouraging me to drop off returns at the stores, not to use the mail system, because they have trucks going back and forth all the time. So it saves them on postage, but it also saves the environment a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see how Amazon handles this.
Yeah, not to put you on the spot in case you don't know exactly, I'm just curious, because the UPS one that I use, they usually just put it in the locker once they've already tried to deliver it, or if it was unsuccessful, or if I didn't ring the doorbell. Is Amazon the same way, or do they directly put it in the locker sometimes, and that's from the get-go where your point of contact is with them?
Yeah, so UPS, by the way, I'm a fan of this happening too. When they can't come to your home or you're not there, they just put it in that locker, and that's pretty cool instead of sending a truck again and again and again and wasting a lot of gas. With Amazon, they actually ask you when you're deciding shipping whether or not you want to send it to a locker. And usually they promise that it'll be quicker or whatever. You know, they give you some incentive. And especially if it's on your commute, why not?
Yeah.
So that's essentially what they're doing there. And it's pretty nifty. I've used it a couple of times. You know, they give you a little code. You walk up to the locker, you enter in the code, suddenly the door just swings open and bada bing, you've got your thing. So it's pretty cool.
That should be their slogan. Bada bing, you got your thing.
Bada bing, you got your thing.
I like that.
I'll try to trademark that. Get my 25 cents before they do.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. Yeah. Really quickly, before we take a quick break, NBC is launching what they're calling Peacock. They're going to use The Office and Parks and Rec, two shows that I watch a lot on Netflix over and over again, even though I've seen the episodes 20 to 30 times each, probably. But those are really going to be their cornerstone episodes that they launch this new service coming up soon.
Yeah, and I think what's really fascinating here is there's this ongoing debate in the media world about what it takes to have a successful streaming service. And the reason this debate happens is that you've got people like Netflix who get a lot of attention for Stranger Things and Orange is the New Black and all these different things that they do in the new Chris Rock specials. But the thing that a lot of analysts believe is that actually stuff like The Office and Friends make up a very large percentage of their traffic. And of course, Netflix doesn't actually publish this traffic data, so we don't know. And what's interesting is that Peacock is also going to lean on this. Hulu just lost the rights to Seinfeld to Netflix. That'll happen in a couple of years. And then you've got Apple launching their subscription service. And what's interesting about that is that they don't have any back catalog of stuff. It's all new videos, and they've got high-profile people like Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston, Steve Carell, and Oprah, but they are all new stuff. It's unproven. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this stuff plays out, you know? And also, by the way, how much money are you willing to spend on subscriptions every day and every month? All these questions are going to be in the air over the next couple of years, and we're really interested to see how the cards fall. But of course, we had seen that we keep track of all the streaming services. We actually have like the pluses and minuses for each of them. So we're trying to do our best to help you figure out where you want to put your dollars.
Yeah, right now I'm not at the point to cut cable yet because I like still have that option. But of course, the streaming services, they kind of add up. They continue to add up. My Washington Post subscription, they, and eventually I will get to a tipping point where I go, you know what? I'm going to do it. And I wonder, there is a point where that's going to happen for a lot of people.
I believe so, too. And by the way, I'm not alone. There are a lot of executives in the media world who tell me that they suspect most people aren't going to want to have like 40 subscriptions, right? So who wins here is going to be really fascinating. You remember the smartphone wars between Apple and Samsung? This is going to get really heated. We're going to start seeing these people really go for our dollars. It's going to be really fascinating to watch.
Joined by Ian Schur. You know, Ian, every time I get the stories that we want to talk about today from CNET, I carve out a little time and I'm able to dive into them and get the gist and can't wait to talk with you about them. I love everything space, and I started reading Erica Argueta. Is that how you pronounce her last name?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I did not carve out enough time for this one. This is an incredible feature that just explores and really dives into one of these astronauts and her entire history and this great thing, and now I've already bookmarked it to finish it later because it really is a deep dive, but it's all about how space medicine, the things that happen, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of miles from Earth, the experiments that they do, I mean, they're not just for whether we're going to find out whether astronauts can get to Mars. They're for a lot of things that happen here, too.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the really interesting things. So first off, the subject of our story, she is actually the second Hispanic woman to be in space. And what I love about her more than anything is that she was part of the space camp people, which if you didn't know what space camp is and you have a young kid, you have to look into this. So Huntsville, Alabama, I think there's one in Florida. There used to be one in California, but they shut it down. NASA runs these week-long camps for kids where they learn how to be an astronaut. And it's super cool. And I'm saying that because I did it too. And I had a great time as a kid. Yeah, I'm in there. Okay.
You know, I was going to say, Ian, that does not surprise me in any way.
Yes. It was really awesome. And not just because. So anyway, one of the things that is really great about her is that she talks about a lot of the research they do in space. And as you mentioned, a lot of people kind of assume that the space stuff is really about more space stuff, right? It's about going to the moon or Mars or whatever, and or finding life outside the solar system, blah, blah, blah. And what I think is really cool is that this great story that we have here on CNET is about how a lot of the research actually is going to help us here on Earth, because the way that people's bodies respond to microgravity is actually really interesting, and it's completely different from the way it is on the planet. People go through the astronauts who are in very good physical condition when they leave. After a couple of days, weeks, months, they start to actually go through osteoporosis and other things wow. like that. So they're able to study their bodies in a way that they couldn't do it on Earth, right? Because you've got these extremely healthy people suddenly going through this incredible medical change, finding out why it happens, looking at what their bodies were before and after and all those things. And it's been really interesting. So a lot of that research is there. They're also researching cancer because the way our blood cells work are different in space. And it's just really nifty to see how medical stuff is going on there and the stuff that could help us. And that's something that NASA has always done. And part of the way reason I love NASA is that you can tie a lot of what modern life is here to what they did in, you know, over the last 60 years. And that's just amazing.
Yeah, not only that, it's just incredible because, you know, we trust our scientists, of course. Well, I should say most of us trust our scientists and what they do. there's still so much they don't know, and to follow them along a little bit on this process of discovery is a really cool way to do it. And the CNET article is incredible. I'm only halfway through it, but I can't wait to read the rest. Ian, sure, we're out of time, so I'm just going to tease this. Bill Gates doesn't think that big tech companies should be broken up. Where can people read that story and more, Ian?
Of course, on CNET, although if you know Bill Gates and Microsoft, it's not a surprise.
Yeah, I was going to say, rich person yeah. is supports rich people. I mean, he's a great man in his philanthropy, but yes.
He's got a thoughtful response. But anyway, definitely read it on CNET, please.
Yes, exactly. Ian, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Take care.
WGN. Hey, happy Thursday, everyone. It's 12:37. on this sunny afternoon here in at least downtown Chicago. Things are going pretty well with me. Hope they're going well with you as well. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hey, just earlier this week, more than 400 influential government and business leaders gathered to address issues about trade, economic growth, business cooperation, and a mutual understanding between the U.S. and China. And one of the gentlemen who helped lead the whole thing was Mr. Pin Yi, the president of Wanshan American Corporation and the acting chairman of China General Chamber of Commerce here in Chicago. Pin, thanks for joining us here today.
Thank you.
So how did the event go? How did the gala go?
Yeah, it was great, you know, better than what we originally thought. So very exciting to see, you know, the interest is still here and the potential is still here, too.
How much, obviously, at the federal level, we hear a lot about tension between the two countries, tariffs back and forth, potential trade war, trade war, those sorts of things. But between business leaders, you know, mano a mano, women and men in a room together, I imagine relations are friendly and things happen in that room.
Yeah, for sure. You know, when you come back to the day-to-day business, and it's just a matter of how we try to find a common ground and then negotiate a better way to mutually benefit on both sides. And obviously, you know, issues at a national level, issues on the political front are still there. But in the meantime, I would say, you know, this was a little surprise to us. You know, we sold it out for the gala dinner. And we have a 450 seat. We have more people want to come. So clearly people are still very interested.
Yeah, two of the biggest world economies, if not the two biggest world economies, obviously want to have a good relationship with each other, certainly on a business level and a trade level, too. There's going to be some fractures in that, of course, along the way. That's to be expected. But what sorts of things, what sorts of takeaways did you have? What sort of great conversations were happening there?
Once we learned, you know, from all the speakers is that to help the relationship, we need to have a better communication. There's a lot of misunderstanding or no understanding, which has caused significant issues. And obviously, you know, we're all part of that. So we need to do everything we can to build a more bridge, connect more people, let the people really talk to each other, even debate, you know, that is could be still very helpful.
Do you talk a lot about Chinese investment in the United States as a part of it, or do you focus more on the business, you know, the trade aspects of things?
Actually, both. You know, Midwest is a great place for the U.S.-China business relationship. You can talk about this is the Rust Belt, which means there is a lot of investment, you know, coming from China in the Midwest. And also you can talk about this is the Corn Belt, which means that, you know, China is obviously a huge market for the agriculture product from Midwest. So we talk about the both, you know. In fact, both are very important to the business relationship between the two countries.
So you can share as much as you want or as much as you little, but I'm just curious on the pulse of what people think about President Trump and his actions towards China and vice versa. What's the honest opinion of people in the room about how that is going?
I would say we didn't really talk that much about the national level subject or the political subject about the trade negotiation, but overwhelmingly everybody think, you know, we need to find a way to be able to work together. And, you know, separating from China or decoupling the relationship is not the best option. And although, you know, everybody talk about there's a truly different opinion, different situation, and but at the end, you know, to gain, not to lose, is to find a way to be able to work together.
I found it incredible. One of the stats that I see that my producer Bennett gave me was in the last 17 years or from 2000 to 2017, Chinese companies investing over $20 billion here in our Midwestern states. That adds up to a ton of jobs and a ton of commerce here.
Oh, yeah. And actually, up to 2017, it was, you know, increasing dramatically every year. I think 2017, if I remember correctly, was more than from 2000, the combining from 2000 to 2015 was less than the 2017, you know, the total investment. Yeah.
Wow.
And then we see a very big cliff in the 2018 was like a drop, like 90% or 88%, depending on which report, you know, you read. And so we just need to try to find a way to back, you know, get that one back on track again.
I imagine a lot of mayors, representatives. I saw the former governor of Illinois, Pat Quinn, was there. I imagine a lot of these folks give speeches, but is there a lot of time, you know, in between these speeches? I mean, it's a big gala. I think we've all been to similar things like this where the real talk, the real interesting aspects happen kind of after everyone can kind of break apart and start talking, shaking hands, and going one-on-one.
Yeah, and we have guests coming from seven different cities in China. So Beijing, Shanghai, which are the two largest cities in China, then Hangzhou, Qingdao, Shenyang, Wuhan, and Chengdu. And so, you know, we are very impressed about those people who are still believing in the USA and committing to keep investing in the United States, which is great, you know. And just for one small correction, you know, Governor Quinn was not there. He had things got tied up. But we have a governor, former governor from Michigan, former governor from Kansas, former governor from Missouri, and also Governor Pritzker was there too, you know.
So I know this event kind of commemorated 40 years of trade relationships between China and the United States, of course, on a diplomatic and diplomatic relations, too, going back to 1979. What is the one or two things that we need to do to ensure that we can celebrate 50, 60, 70 years, have these things happen in the future in a harmonious way?
As long as we keep talking, that's always the key issue. And to shut the door, and if we're not talking, then no matter how good you are on both sides, nothing is going to happen. And as long as the door is open, we're talking, even we're wrestling, that's okay, you know. I mean, when you have a different opinion, all you need to do is just sit down and work out the difference, or maybe just focus on the good things that can help both countries.
Amen to that. Open communication. Pin Nee, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, sir.
All right, we're going to continue things on now with the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Usually, the strikes that go on in Chicago come from the teachers' union, but this week the spotlight will shine on over 2,000 nurses that are preparing to strike on Friday. The strike stems from the union contract negotiations at the University of Chicago Hospital. It's scheduled to be a one-day strike, but the Tribune reports that the hospital already took measures to fill the voids and even send some younger patients to other hospitals, so there's not a lapse in their medical care. The U of C hospital is regularly ranked among the top medical facilities in the state and currently has 618 beds for patients. So keep this and the nurses in mind as you travel around Hyde Park on Friday. And speaking of traveling around, the Boeing CEO is trying to get travelers back on Boeing 737s. The House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee has requested Dennis Muilenburg to testify at a hearing about the never-ending story surrounding the 737 crashes. Boeing stock hasn't seen any company-ending fluctuations since the incidents, but all major airlines have grounded the plane until the situation is resolved. Wall Street will always keep an eye out. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Oh, the conversations Amy Guth and I have off air that we cannot share on the air.
We're cracking ourselves up in here, but another fine music choice to welcome me to the studio.
Absolutely. Do you want to get a random out of context text from Bill and Wendy?
Sure,
as we started off? That's what we've been doing all week. So Bill and Wendy, obviously on the stream. Someone chimed in, Song of the South is an American folktale. It's not from Disney. Okay. I don't know what that's about, but I'm curious to see what they're talking about on the stream. You can, too, and catch their podcast later on WGNradio.com. That one wasn't as fun as the other ones. Amy Guth from The Daily Gist. Let's chat about... Okay, so I've been reading this article that you pulled up about America's power grid, and I love stories about renewable energy and how much cheaper it's getting, but there's a giant swath of the area, including Chicago, to the east, which is just not getting on board, and I want to know, and the article kind of dives into it, is it A, because we don't have as much sun and we don't have as much wind, or is it B, because we're going over a large swath of the country that relies on coal and natural gas, so the economics of it, the pressure of local jobs keeps it there, or is it a little bit of both?
It's, you know, always follow the money, right?
Yeah.
So this is a really interesting story. The headline is particularly provocative because it says every American power grid is getting a lot greener, except the one that matters.
Right.
So this is this very, very big power grid. It serves about 65 million Americans. It's known as the PJM interconnection. Mm-hmm. And so it serves all these people. There's a lot of competing issues here because one of them is in some parts of this country, natural gas is just a lot less expensive. Mm-hmm. There's also, because it covers such a big swath of land, not everybody in all of those municipalities and states are going to have the same priorities. And sometimes those priorities fight for dominance. Mm. So it's really interesting. This is a very good long read. So I encourage yes. everybody to kind of dive into it because it's really, really interesting. And it's you can find it at chicagobusiness.com. But there are some interesting details that emerge in it. One of them is that very, very soon, 90% of the, you know, of the non-renewable kind of facilities, by the time they pay for themselves, they're going to be like,
they're going to be too expensive
to run. Yes. I mean, it's such a fascinating kind of look at, we're in this very, very careful moment, right? Very mm-hmm. precarious moment where a lot of pivots need to happen really fast.
Yes.
And there's some, think tanks that are, you know, that talked to the reporter in this article that really kind of took a look at like, this is going to happen fast. Like we're creeping up to it, but it's going to happen so quickly. Somebody's just going to, basically, you just kind of have to like pull off the Band-Aid and go there. It might be a little costly at first, but then there's some municipalities that are like, well, but as we saw in Texas, you know, this year with some, where the power grid was challenged with some, you know, threatening widespread blackouts, a backup is still needed.
Yes.
You know,
right. You still need that there and you can't shut them all down.
You can't shut that all down. And when we're looking at like increasingly extreme weather and we're here in hurricane season right now, watching some activity in the Gulf, same deal. You know, we need these backup solutions. So it's a weird time we're in where this is the pivot, but it's all kind of told through the lens of this one power grid that serves so many Americans.
Yeah. There's a lot of good news in here though. At least took that.
I think so too.
I looked at Texas and I was shocked because I was like, well, you know, whatever dominates your natural or your local economics, you got a lot of people. And I was like, oh, Texas, man, it's oil rich. They probably get all their energy from oil. That's not the case.
Not the case.
In fact, they had a brand new gas plant they had to shut down because it wasn't making any money. It was built this decade. So it's just a strange world where Texas in many ways is leading the energy ability. And it's not because they're all, you know, as we know, they're not all wearing their blue flags or they're not all Democrats. It's because it's cheaper.
It's just cheaper. Right. I mean, as usual, right, it comes down to like, what is the most cost effective thing to do? It often comes down to the bottom line. There's also noted in this story, there's a look at the $70 billion with a B offshore wind farm that's happening in the Atlantic. That's so interesting. I mean, this is just a kind of, to me, a snapshot of a really interesting moment in our energy supply of how we're like, people have been like, well, it's too expensive to switch to solar or wind, mm-hmm. but like tomorrow it's going to be too expensive not to.
Well, and you know, business leaders, agree with them, disagree with them, those that lead our coal plants or those that lead our natural gas, they want a piece of the action too, I'm sure. I'm just curious if they're all, and you may not know the answer, I'm sure someone is talking about this though, I'm sure they've got to be investing in this new renewable future as well, or are they straggling on and they're hanging on to dear life to what they know well, and that could be the detriment to them.
Well, that's unclear, but you know, I think there is little debate as to whether or not natural gas is still needed. So I think there's not a lot of, hey, we need to just abandon the ship here. So it is, yeah, it's a delicate balance between like, let's put our eggs in this future basket, mm-hmm. even though we may not need it right this moment. However, we still need to pay for it in this old way and because that's what we can afford and be most cost effective.
I cannot wait for it to be cheaper everywhere, the renewable energy, just so we could just end this climate debate. Because I, you know, climate change is clearly, for me, I believe a no-brainer. It's happening, obvious to me. I know some people disagree out there. But look, when it's cheap, it doesn't matter what you believe about climate change. It's cheaper, so we should do it.
Well, that's the thing. And there's like, you can think whatever you want about science and data, but at the end of the day, like that's what's going to move people to more renewable options when the traditional options are just no longer affordable.
All right, Amy Guth, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks.